A horror of our history. That's how the Senate committee last year described the practice of forced adoption in this country between the 1950s and 1970s. This might be your story. Tomorrow in the Grand Hall of Parliament House in Canberra, the Prime Minister will make a formal apology to you and to the other families affected by the practice. Up to 250,000 babies were taken from their mothers, who were mostly young, mostly unmarried women. Some had to give up children for adoption because they were emphatically not able to receive economic support for children born outside of wedlock. Many were never reunited. Nearly all states and territories have now given their own formal apologies. The Northern Territory has announced its intention to. ABC Open has been inviting people to contribute photos and stories to a simple but super powerful project called Separation. Here's artist and songwriter Lena Eve.
I was 17 and found myself pregnant to my first boyfriend. I was reading a women's magazine and they said that Crown Street Hospital helps young women who are pregnant and unmarried. So I decided to travel from Melbourne to Sydney and go to Crown Street Hospital seeking help. Each time I saw the social worker, it seemed that she had more reasons of why it would be better for the baby if I signed adoption papers. But at that point, I was still very adamant that I wanted to keep my baby. I applied for my records, my social records and my medical records, and here's what they said. Still keeping the baby, still definitely keeping the baby at this time. This is a treatment record on the day of her birth. Here it says BFA, which means baby for adoption, when I still hadn't made any agreements that I would actually sign adoption papers.
The babe was born in sorrow. The babe was born in fear. They treated the young girl with hate and scorn.
When I arrived at Crown Street Hospital, about to have my baby, I was shoved into a room and left there on my own with the pains building up. And then eventually when they came in and I must have been fully dilated, they were yelling at me to push. That was about the only time that they addressed me. Then finally I was able to push my child into the world. But right at that last moment of pushing, they held a pillow in front of my face the whole time that my baby was coming out, so I couldn't see what I'd given birth to. And I immediately thought there must be something really, really wrong.
They pushed her to give up the babe. They said she wasn't fit.
And I asked to see my baby and they said nothing, and they gave me some injection or other, and I don't remember another thing until I woke up in a totally different place. And I thought I was in a nightmare. I just couldn't understand what was going on or where I was. And it turned out I'd been moved to a totally different hospital just to make sure that there was no way I could sneak down and look at my baby. It was part of what Crown Street Hospital did in order to make sure that we didn't connect with our children.
Lena Eve's story there, which was recorded by ABC Open producer Catherine Marciniak, and I urge you to look at more stories at abc.net.au/open. Marie Coleman trained as a social worker in the early 1950s. Has had a long career as a trailblazer in social policy and family planning. She served in senior roles under both the Whitlam and Fraser governments. In fact, she was the first woman to head up a Commonwealth statutory authority. She joins us this morning on the program. Welcome, Marie.
Good morning.
You must have witnessed directly many, many, many situations like Lena's.
Look, I witnessed some. I don't want to put the number too high, but the thing to realise about that period is that it was a society that was very, very punitive towards girls who became pregnant out of wedlock. There were, for a start, you couldn't access family planning. There was no family planning. You would have been very lucky if your boyfriend was brave enough in a small country town to go into the local chemist shop to buy condoms. Mm. The dice were loaded. Girls really had the option of surrendering the baby for adoption, a shotgun marriage, maybe being able to keep it if they had an extremely supportive family that was going to be able to handle the social stigma associated with the unmarried baby.
The shame was enormous, wasn't it?
The shame was shocking. So that in that clip we just heard of the story of the young woman who went from Sydney to Melbourne to Sydney, girls were being sent away from home so that no story could get back to the local people, local society that the girl lived in. The shame was enormous. And even had a 17-year-old been able to keep her baby, you would have to wonder what sort of family support she was going to be given to help her manage to keep the baby. Oh, and adding to that, no childcare either.
No childcare, no welfare payments available to mothers who had children outside of marriage. In fact, you provocatively described the attitude towards unmarried motherhood as being regarded as a type of pathology, Murray.
Well, it was. It was regarded as a type of pathology. The other thing that feeds into discussion of this, of course, is that we've always had methods, bad or not, to try to deal with couples who face the problem of infertility. Now, bear in mind that by the 50s, people were becoming aware, slowly, that the outcomes for children who grew up in children's homes were not too good. And that was well before we discovered child sexual abuse and various other things. There was seen to be a benefit in placing children with infertile couples. Benefit to the infertile couples, benefit to the child if it wasn't going to have to grow up in the children's institution. That was essentially the reasoning. But let me also make the point to you that there was very little demand for the adoption of children with a disability or children, say, from an Aboriginal or from another ethnic minority. They weren't sought after. They were much more likely to wind up in institutions.
There was also this notion that young women having babies out of wedlock were kind of being exposed to a moral danger. There was a massive moral danger panic here, wasn't there?
Oh, well, there was indeed, and I vividly recall the fact was, of course, if the girl was under 16 at the time of conception, then she could be charged with having been exposed to moral danger, and her partner, the person responsible for the pregnancy, could be also proceeded against for interfering with a minor.
Murray, your career spans the full breadth of those years of forced adoption. As a young social worker, I want to read a quote from the ABC Open Project. Mary Lee writes this. It's a very powerful statement. I was drugged for the birth and woke up in the broken leg ward. I sobbed until the social worker took me to the maternity ward and allowed me to see my baby for 1 minute. I felt a jolt of joy. My baby's eyes were my eyes. I hadn't signed any forms, but I wasn't allowed to pick her up. I was drugged and sick. The social worker said a married couple would do a much better job of bringing her up than I could. She said I was being selfish. She said I should go home and get on with my life. I should forget. And she mentions a social worker here, and I wonder how you felt as a young social worker witnessing some of these adoptions.
Well, I was frankly appalled, but indeed I didn't stay involved in adoption work. I moved into other spheres. It was something that I always felt myself was a mistake, but where I directed my energies later was in helping the campaign to develop the original pension for unmarried girls, and in trying to get an expansion of childcare. These are the things that drive people like me into starting to look at what we need to change in terms of social policies.
Yes, indeed. And this was also the era of, pre the era of female contraception. So,
oh, yes.
I mean, abortion and backyard abortions were a big issue.
Yes, they were indeed a very big issue, but many single girls would have had difficulty in finding the cash to go to one of the doctors who was practicing as an illegal abortionist, but nevertheless a doctor. And so there was a very high rate of death from septicemia from young women who went to the backyard abortionists.
Murray, as you mentioned, I mean, you started to spearhead, you were involved in spearheading a campaign. How significant, in Victoria, and then it led to a national equivalent, was the Council of the Single Mother and Her Child?
Look, I think those young women who started the Council of the Single Mother and Her Child were unbelievably courageous. They were extremely important in bringing to the fore the fact that this wasn't a pathology of incompetent people who somehow deserved to go away and bury their heads. These were nice, ordinary girls, the girl next door, so to speak, who were being treated shamefully, had been treated shamefully, but these girls came out and had the courage to talk about their experiences.
What did that campaign achieve?
Well, I think it made it a great deal easier for the Whitlam government to make a single parent pension.
Just we're getting a little bit of interference with your mobile phone, but I do want to ask about fathers, because they're not in the title of the Council of the Single Mother and Her Child. Fathers lost children here too.
Fathers did, but in many cases, I certainly came across many cases where there was little likelihood of the male person who had impregnated the girl wanting to take any responsibility. So I'm not trying to be denigrating of all of the fathers. I'm just saying that in most of the cases that I had any contact with...
Yes, I wonder
they disappeared.
I wonder if that had an impact on many men in their middle age later on about the children that they'd lost. I wonder how you view... well, first of all, I'd like to just ask, how significant then was the single mother's pension? Because the policy before then was extraordinary. I mean, women who had a baby out of wedlock, even if they had a series of children before that baby in wedlock, could not receive any financial support or a single mother's pension for that last child, because that one child had not been born in wedlock.
Well, that's the situation with somebody who might have been on the civilian widow's pension, as it used to be called. They might be, in those days there was a Class A and a Class B civilian widow's pension. One was for a woman who was actually widowed. One was for a woman who had been in a relationship for some time, which had it had broken down. Now, those women received a pension in respect of the children by the previous relationship. Mm. They weren't entitled to a pension in respect of the illegitimate child, of the child born after that pension had been granted.
Which left some women in very difficult situations. How do you view the current welfare policies regarding single mothers? I mean, certainly the stated emphasis is on getting mothers back to work as early as possible, or certainly when their children are old enough for them deemed to be considered appropriate for them to go to work. How do you view the current situation then, and attitude towards single mums?
I think some of it remains punitive. And given that we've now abolished any distinction between the formerly married woman and the never married woman, and they're all just called sole parents, many women who feel that, who have perhaps been widowed or divorced, certainly feel that they incur a stigma still, because people have stereotypical assumptions that all single parents are 16-year-old girls who've had a baby so that they can get the baby bonus.
All tarred with the same brush. It's an extraordinary history. How significant do you think the policy is tomorrow?
Well, I think...
I beg your pardon.
Well, I think the apology is obviously something important for those people. We have to bear in mind that there were also many, many women who were whose children were adopted, but whose children have had no problems about having grown up in an adoptive family. So there are people who've been helpful. There have been other problems, but I don't think the apology solves everything. It's an important contribution to helping people move on.
Always a start, isn't it? Murray Coleman, thank you very much for joining us. It was a slightly crackly old phone line, that one, but we're glad we stuck with it. Thanks.
Thank you. Right here. Good night.
Marie Coleman, a trailblazer in family planning, in advocacy for parents, for children, former public servant during the Whitlam and Fraser government era, and active in the women's movement over many, many decades there. And I've posted the link on the Facebook page of the ABC Open Project called Separation. Really powerful, evocative images. A single photo with some text underneath it can tell so much. Head to abc.net.au/open or to the Life Matters website, and you can tune in to the apology tomorrow. Fran Kelly will be picking up with an interview in relation to that tomorrow morning as well, with a personal story. Coming up, is Facebook becoming more friendly?